My tongue speaks so they will know, giving voice to the legacy that has come before. Sojourner, Ida, Dorothy, Mary, Ella, Maya Angelou, others left out of history books, many refusing to, denying my humanity, but I stand and demand. From birthing of a civilization to nurturing a nation, we've been right here. I breast the comfort of men and suckling babies. How dare they not see me? Strength, genius, and beauty. I give voice to this beautiful struggle to shine and bring forth the light, staking claim to our birthright and inheritance of this earth, an overflow of compassion and justice. Using my voice to tell the children, telling the stories of Black excellence, Africans, speaking truth to power, if only for 1 hour, they will stop and know that. My tongue speaks so they will know that. Ain't I a woman?
This is Voices of Advocacy Radio with your host, Lakeisha Gray Sewell, showcasing leading activists, community servants, and entrepreneurs. You are now tuned in to truth, community passion, and amplified legacy. Can you hear it? It's Voices of Advocacy Radio.
Thank you for joining us here on another edition of Voices of Advocacy Radio. It is an honor for us to share with our audience the wonderful, wonderful, wonderful advocate, worker. So much I can say about this woman. She is, more than anything, a woman of God and absolutely an advocate for justice. Miss Liz S. Alexander, I'm so happy to have her with us. Let me just give you all just a little quick, her bio is so extensive. This woman has done so much. I'll try to condense it down. So Liz is, as she says, a woman on a journey of becoming. Woo! And I say that she is all that she is becoming. She is a social worker, a writer, womanist practitioner whose professional interests include community engagement, violence prevention, response to trauma, and justice advocacy for youth. She has a particular interest in justice for girls, and she currently serves as program coordinator for Cook County Justice for Children. She is also, she advocates on behalf of youth who encounter the juvenile court, as well as youth who are already in custody at the juvenile temporary detention center. Liz is also a contributor to the anthology, and I don't even know if we can call it an anthology, but it is a book of writing, Unraveling and Reweaving Sacred Canon in Africana Womanhood. Whew, that just sounds powerful itself. She has written for The Feminist Wire, the For Harriet blog, Prison Culture blog, and the journal The Advocate. Liz writes on the topic of social justice issues related to Black women and girls, their healing and wholeness. She received her MSW from the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration with a concentration in violence and prevention and trauma, a Master of Religious Leadership from the Chicago Theological Seminary with a concentration in social transformation. She's a Spelman alum. I could go on and on and on. This woman is the bomb.
Sis, you know, and I'm just so grateful for you. You know, I was going to say it takes you know, a sister who herself is a bomb to recognize another sister is the bomb. So kudos to you and all your work. So thank you, and I'm honored to be you know, a guest on this incredible show. You know, I just wanted to say I formerly served as the program coordinator for Cook County Justice for Children, an incredible organization that's doing incredible, important work on behalf of justice-involved youth in Chicago.
That's right, because you made the transition. You've moved to New York, so you're no longer here. But you were doing
exactly
something to that point. That's right, that's right. And that move is less than a month old. Wow. I'm fine.
You know, and it's funny. It feels like that. And it's funny that it feels like that to you, because for me, it feels like I've been out here for ages. You know,
yeah.
And it's actually been about 10 weeks. And it still blows my mind when I reflect on it. So I've been here a little over, I think now approaching 2 months.
2 months. Wow. God is good.
I'm telling you all the time.
We're sending love and light, and I'm just so grateful for platforms like this where even though space and distance is between us, our voices can reach across the land and all over the globe. So I'm just so grateful for it. I don't take this opportunity to share powerful voices like yours, powerful movements like the one you're starting, the Concern and the Awareness for Girls' Justice. I am so glad that I am able to facilitate this. So thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I want to just ask the first question is, what led you to become involved? What was the impetus for you to get involved with juvenile justice, and specifically, why focus on girls?
Right. So what got me involved into the area of juvenile justice is my own personal experience. I currently have a brother who's 1 year older than me, who's serving a sentence, a 22-year sentence for manslaughter. You know, and as I reflect over his journey thus far, you know, I recall he first got his introduction into the juvenile criminal justice system as a young person, you know, as a juvenile. And unfortunately, at that time, our family did not know, you know, the ins and outs of the system. We didn't have, proper support, you know, when he first got in, we didn't have proper support. We didn't know what was going on. And then my brother, too, it's a lot of factors that's going on in his particular case. He also suffers from mental illness. You know, so all these, you know, contributing factors, we didn't know how to protect him, you know. And so as he continued to go and spiral in deep into this system, you know, there wasn't appropriate intervention. And so that really did a number on me and on our family, of course. It affected everybody, his incarceration. And so when he got older and committed his most recent offense, I became interested in looking at the connection. And so when I just think about, you know, our family context and dynamic and story, you know, for my brother and all of us, actually, my siblings and I, we lost our mother young, you know, after our parents divorced, you know, our father wasn't really present, you know, we pretty much had each other, you know, and so we had all these risk factors, you know, and you know, we were susceptible to a lot. You know, a lot of things. So living in a lower middle class, community, in a community where the education system wasn't the best. So, I mean, there were all these things. And unfortunately, my brother got caught up, you know. But outside of that, I also recognized, as I continued to look at this pattern further, that there was also a connection between trauma and delinquency. And so, decided to really study this further in graduate school, which is what led me to the University of Chicago, because they actually had a program, one of the few schools that actually have a program with a focus in violence prevention and trauma, you know. And so once I went and, you know, furthered my studies in this area, it just became really apparent. So got into that work in Chicago. I've been fortunate to have roles where it afforded me spaces at the table, right? So I've been at the table with major juvenile justice stakeholders, with folks who are doing the work on the ground. I've been in spaces with, you know, Mayor Rahm Emanuel, Bruce Rauner, the current governor, and major players in the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice. And so, you know, but I realized, though, from being at this table, when we talked about, you know, a lot, whether it was prevention, diversion, intervention, girls were never a part of the conversation. And I found that particularly interesting because it directly conflicted with my experience in going to the prison, you know, where I would see these girls. In fact, I went to a talent show. What you say, sis?
I was saying absolutely.
In fact, I went to a talent show at the Juvenile Temporary Detention Center. At this time, all the girls who had been incarcerated at this point had been incarcerated for sex trafficking. You know, and I thought that was really interesting. But again, at these decision tables, these things are never brought up. I mean, absolute silence. You know, and so when I started to really explore the issues deeper, then I started asking questions. And so, you know, literally the questions would be like, okay, well, what about girls when we talk about intervention? When we talk about, you know, trauma-informed care? Okay, well, what about the girls? And sis, I was met with silence. And in the time where I wasn't met with silence, I was met with feedback, you know, such as, oh, you know, the girls, you know, just all these gestures to me that you know, that further built on, like the prejudices against girls, you know, that girls are a lot, you know, that girls are too much, that girls are, you know, manipulative, that girls are, you know, all these negative things. And so the feedback from these stakeholders mirrored that, you know, and I thought which is horrific and extremely problematic. And it really, outraged me to the point where, you know what, I decided to take a stand and do something about it.
And that's very, I'm so glad for the African American, what is it? It's the Black Girls Matter campaign that came out this last year, February, that the African American Policy Forum started, and the conversation about, you know, the too much interaction and the disproportionate interaction of our girls with juvenile justice system for all manner of, like you said, sex trafficking, anything that from sex trafficking to truancy. So tell me more about what you find outside of the silence that you encounter when in these conversations. What else do you think or have you noticed that is most alarming to you, or that you find to be most compelling for you to continue to do the work?
So I found that girls actually are overwhelmingly not a threat to public society, to public safety. To the largest society, they're not a threat. Many of the offenses that they're incarcerated for are statutory offenses and nonviolent offenses. And so when I say statutory offenses, I mean crimes that are only crimes if they're committed by youth. So like, for example, running away, or for example, violating curfew. You know, so things like that. You know, also in the cases, and in the nonviolent offenses, the girls, some of the offenses look like prostitution. And then we can talk about, and I guess further in the conversation, we could talk about, you know, this whole concept of child prostitute.
Right.
You know, and how this country continues to criminalize these girls, you know, who are these survivors of trafficking, who are rescued. So instead of them being sent to rehabilitative centers once they're rescued, they're actually sent into detention. So we can talk about, you know, how just egregious and horrific, you know, that is, and its impact on our girls. You know, also girls are found to be incarcerated for, like I said, violation of curfew. It's a lot of aggravated assault. It's interesting, you know, as I talk about aggravated assault, right, because that has to be broken down and deconstructed. You know, girls, we don't have enough conversations about violence that goes on in the home against girls, you know, from incest to living in chaotic environments to you know, protecting themselves from violent parents, you know. Mm-hmm. So let me give a scenario, for example, and I'm going to pull all these things that I named together. So, you know, picture a girl, oldest of three, living in a home with a mom and a boyfriend, right? And so, you know, of course, the years, the boyfriend sneaks in this child's room at night, you know. So this one night, this girl is fed up and she, you know, decides to fight this man back, right? So it creates this altercation, you know. The mom then, of course, wakes up, and when she finds out what's going on, you know, and then the girl, you know, just says, look, I've been abused or whatever. Instead of taking this child's side, the mom takes the side of the boyfriend, right? And then they create this whole brawl. So what happens now is the mother calls the police, right? And then the child is taken out of the home, right? And charged with, in most cases, domestic adolescent battery, which is a real offense. Right, and so that's what I mean. So when we look at the records, right, we only see domestic, adolescent domestic battery or assault, but we don't look at, you know, the factors that led to this scenario, you know. And so that is the scenario. 40% of girls, you know, who are currently involved in it, who are currently incarcerated right now in the juvenile justice system, come from that kind of context.
And this is where I don't. This is where my heart is pained, because it's like, why wouldn't you? Even if that were the case, if you were called to the home for a domestic dispute, whatever it is, if the girl is being truant, if she's not coming, if she's violence against her peers, whatever it is, why is it not a deeper look taken? We know that these are, again, children. So that's what really blows me is why isn't it a deeper look taken? Why is it the first, you know, why is it just instantaneous detention and incarceration?
You know, and it's funny that you say that, and thank you for pointing that out. Especially, I think it's very timely that you raised that, especially given our presidential election, right, and who some of the candidates are. And so when I think of Clinton, for example, you know, we got to go back, you know, when her husband Bill was in office and how she, you know, coined the term super predators, right, which and how that super predators propaganda, how it negatively impacted our children, and we still suffer from that today. And so what it implies is that, you know, children who exhibit, like, these behaviors, right, or, you know, as the criminologists like to say, criminogenic tendencies, so it can look like outbursts, it can look like whatever, you know, they're predisposed to committing violent acts as adults. So this was the propaganda. This was the myth around that. And so let me just pause and thank Hillary Clinton for that, right? And so that's what I mean. We have come because of that, you know, and its impact on public perception. You know, we don't allow children to be children, one, right? Because many of these children, they are the only display appropriate adolescent behaviors. So we don't even talk about, you know, what does it look like, where they are developmentally. Right. All we know is, you know, that, you know, for a teenager, for example, to talk back or to be hostile or whatever, you know, all we know is that to attack them for that behavior or to penalize them for that behavior, although, you know, typically it's normal adolescent behavior. And so it looks different for different, you know, ethnicities. You know, so even Black girls, for example, when we look at school suspensions, right, and we want to, you know, and the African American Policy Forum produced this report, you know, pushed out, overprotected, and it really examined, you know, just the epidemic of expulsion rates for Black girls in comparison to other ethnic groups. You know, and so, and in that report, you know, it showed that girls are disproportionately expelled. One of the things that it identified is because teacher bias. You know, and school official bias, which are seeped and rooted in the stereotypes and prejudices against Black girls, right? Deeply rooted ultimately in this white supremacist paradigm and racism and sexism. You know what I mean? So those are the underlying structural issues, you know, that affect, you know, that affect how we criminalize children. What would you say?
I was just going to say, because there's an inherent belief that our girls are, you know, violent, pathological, that there's something wrong, that there's nothing right about them, that they have no, you know, that they constantly need to be reprimanded, disciplined, and as Hillary Clinton said, brought to heel. So, yes.
And it's horrible. And then we don't even account, so aside from that, you know, we also don't account for trauma, you know, and what that looks like. You know, when I think of girls who are in the justice system, many of them come from impoverished neighborhoods, right? Many of them come from dysfunctional families. Many of them have experienced some form of physical or sexual abuse. You know, where Black and Native American and Latino girls are disproportionately represent these groups, you know, in comparison to their white counterparts. You know, and when we talk about trauma and its impact on development and its literal impact on the brain, many children, and this is just across the spectrum, who have experienced trauma manifest what we call maladaptive behaviors. So, you know, inappropriate behaviors, and it can look like so many different things. It can mask as like ADD or oppositional defiance disorder or emotional disturbance, you know. And so these behaviors, you know, it's actually a cry for help. You know, it is a language, you know, literally that says, see me, I'm hurting.
Absolutely.
You know, so we don't even account for that. What we do, unfortunately, now, and especially with our girls, is we criminalize these children for their victimization.
And I that resonates so deeply with me, sis, because I was that girl, you know. When the African American Policy Forum came out with the whole Black Girls Matter hashtag and movement, after they released Pushed Out, Over Policed and Underprotected, I reeked because I remember, I recall vividly, I spent more than 20 days of my high school career being suspended while I attended an all-white, a predominantly white high school. When I got to a black high school, that it was completely different. It's just amazing, the encounters with the police from the students, you know what I mean? All of those things where, thank God for you and the work you're doing. Thank God for reports and more information that's coming out, because like you said, it's all steeped and deeply rooted in white supremacy thinking and structural violence and institutional racism. And for so many years, generations, this wasn't even a conversation to begin to protect our girls. Like, this is just the work you're doing is just the beginning of it. But just think about how many years before this work wasn't even addressed. So our girls then internalize and appropriate the misgivings about themselves, stigmas, and the negative stereotypes. So now you don't even feel, you feel that you're inherently bad as well. So it's a lot. It's a lot. Right.
Mhm. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and I actually have now joined a group of women and scholars and activists, you know, who are doing this work. You know, and so I'm glad that I can, you know, now be in solidarity, you know, with these folks to really bring visibility to this issue. You know, in a way that has never been done before. And I think that we are in an interesting space, especially now with the use of technology and the role of social media and how it, you know, literally gives you direct access to the consumer and general public. You know, and so, and yeah, and it's critical. It's a critical tool and I think a critical a piece, you know, in addressing these social issues.
Yeah, because I always say my work is in dismantling what the story that the media tells, right? So thank God for the network that you're speaking about. Thank God for the fact that we can follow a hashtag and everybody can tell their story and more people can connect their work as it, and, you know, there can be more organized efforts because the media is a big part of the story. The media is a big part of why is at the crux of a lot of behaviors and a lot of socialized behaviors. And so until we are able to really dismantle that narrative and tell our own story, our girls will forever be painted the way that the lion sees them. So
yeah, you're absolutely right.
So tell me a little about your project. Well, not a little. I want you to tell me all about it. The project that you found and started, She Dreams of Freedom.
Yeah, so She Dreams of Freedom came out of an experience when I was in the prison, you know, you know, saw a child as young as 13 serving out a sentence, right? And so just for folks who don't know, jail is a space where you go and you are, you know, you get sentenced. So it's like a, you know, so your sentence can be short term, so, you know, you're there for the weekend, you can go home, you know, and then and it's also a waiting period. So once you see the judge and you are given a sentence, then you go into a prison, right? So I just want to provide that backdrop because so I, you know, had an opportunity where I went into a prison, a girl's prison, and seen a child as young as 13 in that prison. So, you know, anybody, you know, of conscience would be like, well, this baby has only been on this earth 13 years. What could she have done to be in prison? You know, so, you know, really, you know, and so what came for me is just like, you know, she, at what point did this child have a chance? You know, and so that's where this whole concept of She Dreams of Freedom, you know, came from that space. You know, at what point is she free? You know, physically, spiritually, emotionally, psychologically. You know, and so, you know, when I saw her and saw the rest of these girls, you know, I and it could be my own stuff too, because I was that girl too. I was never incarcerated, but like you said, I had my stories, right? But it was just like this quest for freedom, you know, in all forms. So that's how the whole concept came about. But I said, you know, just to connect back to our conversation about media, you know, I said, you know, I want to get these girls' stories out. You know, after having learned more and more about this issue, you know, and many of the complexities of the issue and just the overwhelming victimization, I said, you know what, many people don't even know about this stuff. Like I did. You know, I didn't know.
Right.
You know, and so when I did, I got hooked. You know, and I'm like, you know what? I want to work in partnership with girls to tell their stories. And I say I want to work in partnership is because, you know, what we do in social service advocacy, you know, one of the things that I think is actually more harmful, though, you know, some of us come from the best of intentions, is that we assume we know what folk need. You know what I mean? Especially we advocate, that we assume that we know what the population who we advocating for, what they need. I think it's almost impossible to work on behalf of a group of people who are not involved in the process. And I'm talking about at the table, you know,
you
and
know
so I had to,
you know,
go ahead, sis.
You know what I refer to that as?
What?
The missionary mindset. It's the missionary mindset that you're going to come and you're
going
to save people and you're going to give them, you know, their civilization, you know, they're going to give them. And you don't even take it. They have their own human capacity, just like you do, and their own experiences. So don't come tell me what you can do for me. Ask me how you can help me do what I'm already doing, make it better.
Yes.
So, thank you for clarifying.
Yes. You know, and Tehu Cole, he's a Nigerian writer. He actually coined the term the white savior complex. And so some of those characteristics also come out of that. You know, and he specifically talks about, you know, this whole thing about aid, you know, and charities. I mean, he just really breaks it down. But yes, sis. So I said, you know what, with this project, I'm going to work, you know, in partnership with girls because I see that they are experts. I see them as experts of their own experiences, you know. And so for these girls to come out of the context that they have, to have, you know, gone through the system, who better to know? You know, and so I said, you know what, I want to do that and, you know, use media a platform to tell their stories. You know, and so, and not only just tell their stories, but also long term, you know, because I really believe media is a tool for advocacy, you know, use this, one, to educate the general public, two, to raise awareness about the, you know, raise awareness about the issue, but also, you know, as an advocacy tool to eventually shift public policy, you know, and really change how the system views girls and how they develop programs that support girls. Because I say one of my personal missions is to end the pipeline of girls into the juvenile justice system. And I say that just want to spit this fact is that girls are actually the fastest population to be incarcerated right now.
Yeah.
You know, and black girls are leading that. Black girls and Native American girls. And so we don't even think when we hear or we don't even see. You know, no group of girls is as invisible, I would say, as Native American girls. You know, I mean, yes, black girls are disproportionately affected, but Native American girls, you don't even hear anything about them. You know,
well,
though they're only 1% of the general population, they, what, make up, I think, about 13% of the criminal justice system?
And then let me also put in there, too, that the media...
You know what, let me correct that, not 13, they make up 3.5% of girls who are detained and committed. But go ahead.
So we talk about the broader sense of the stereotypes and the stigmas, right? And how even erasure is a form of stereotypes and stigma, right? And if you look in the media right now, the Women's Media Center did a report, and if you look before you see a person of a Native American indigenous person. You will see otherworldly, you'll see aliens and angels and ghosts before you will see a Native American on any popular television show.
Mm.
Now, how deep is that? Aliens and ghosts exist before we ever get a glimpse of an indigenous Native American person.
Wow, sis. Wow. You know, because when I think of too, just, and I think it was a recent article that came out, you know, about the status of Native Americans on reservations. And it was particularly about how the U.S. now is intentionally focusing on the plight of Native Americans because on the reservations they have high rates of suicide, incest, domestic violence, and alcoholism. You know, I mean, so we talk about genocide and all that stuff, you know, not to divert the conversation, but we know that was systemic, you know, and dare I say strategic, you know, but
God, absolutely.
I'm telling you, I'm telling you. And so with the, with, you know, just getting back to the project, with this media component, you know, I envision public service announcements like the one that I actually have out now. You know, I envision using this media to interview girls, you know, to hear what they have to say, you know, interviewing girl advocates, you know, and also seeing this, you know, the media piece, you know, just to really tell the stories in an innovative way. So what I mean is, you know, for example, some of me and some of the folks who I'm working with, we have been in serious discussions about what would it look like to have a web series, you know, that talks about, you know, how a girl, what happens before she enters, what happens at the point of entry, and then when she gets out. And I'm talking about, you know, Orange is the New Black has nothing on some of the stuff that I'm talking about. You know, The Wire has nothing on the stories that I hear, you know, from these girls. You know, so it is just like, how do we create this non-fictional narrative, you know, again, for the purpose of exposure, educating the general public, and really putting pressure politically, you know, to really push our politicians and policymakers, you know, to really take on this issue of girls and the juvenile justice in a serious way. And I want to say, I do want to recognize the National Girls Initiative through the Office of Juvenile Justice, Delinquency, and Prevention. Yeah. You know, so that does exist, and I want to acknowledge that, you know, and the an incredible work that they're doing, and the fact that they have a grant right now that's out, you know, for community organizations and initiatives, et cetera, you know, to do some work with girls who are either justice involved or at risk of being justice involved. So I do want to acknowledge that work, but it's just so much more, you know, more work that we have to do.
And I wanted to just boldly go ahead and state with the project She Dreams of Freedom, as we talk about imprisoning girls and children in general, I would say that if a child has to be in prison, then they were already born in prison. They were already born into a state of incarceration. And so, and as you know, as we said before, that's by design. So they don't just, children don't just come in this world committing crimes and being violent. So whatever society has done to them, I would boldly state and submit that that is the doing of society. And so if society is, you know, is the at the crux of it, at the head of what starts this cycle, then society needs to also take part in the responsibility and accountability of making things right for our children. And prison is not the answer.
I totally agree with you. You know, I totally agree with you. And on that note, it's a book I highly recommend called Ghosts from the Nursery. You know, it's called Tracing the Roots of Violence. You know, and it really talks about, you know, children who committed violent offenses. And a part of it has interviewed, like, you know, like mass murderers, like a what is that guy? Forgot his name. But anyway, so it interviews folks who committed horrific violent crimes, and it, you know, and in the interviews and in the family analyses, it showed that many of the overwhelming things around, you know, children who are violent and adults who, you know, have eventually become violent, they had a serious attachment issues. They didn't develop normal attachments as babies. So it just breaks it all down, you know, to your point. So I highly recommend that book. Again, it's called Ghosts from the Nursery, Tracing the Roots of Violence. You know, it's a must read. You know, and then I want to say, you know, many, like I said, overwhelmingly, our girls are incarcerated for nonviolent offenses, so they don't even commit violent offenses. You know, and so, you know, I say just, you know, as a society, we need to rethink. First off, we need to humanize our children, you know. Second off, you know, the second point is we need to rethink how we criminalize behaviors, you know. And thirdly, we need to look at these things through a trauma-informed lens.
And stop identifying having a sense of self-agency as being criminal or wrong. That because I speak out for myself, because I advocate for myself, even though I'm 12 years old, I still have to be able to do that, regardless of who you are, if you're an authority figure or not. That me speaking and exerting myself, my sense of agency, is not a threat to society.
Right, and especially when we talk about girls of color. right? Because when we, you know, that's not necessarily an issue for white girls, for example, but when black girls do it, they are what? Disrespectful and all that stuff, mm-hmm. right? So we need to have maintain a general standard, you know, for everybody. You know what I mean? But like I said, at the root of it, we know it's this white supremacist, you know, patriarchal society that we live in. So shout out to all the race advocates, because I mean, everybody has a part in this work, seriously.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
absolutely.
Those folks who are in this racial justice movement, everybody has mm-hmm. a part. And that is their work to continue to, you know, dismantle and fight against, you know, racism, you know, that as we see, negatively impact everybody, but, you know, our children in particular. And so, you know, the media peace procedure and the freedom, that's phase one. And phase two, you know, is eventually creating safe spaces, you know, for girls. You know, I was in another prison story, in the same prison, and, you know, was in conversation with a counselor, and she informed me that a child was supposed to go home, you know, a girl was supposed to go home, you know, but the girl had expressed that, you know, she didn't feel safe at home and would rather stay in the prison.
Mm.
Now, let me describe this prison. Now, this is a serious, this is a prison for real, okay? We're talking about, like, a campus, like, you know, with cottages. We're talking about, you know, living in a cell. Well, you know, a cell, you know, it's a steel bolt door. I'm talking about cement walls, right? I'm talking about your standard uniforms. I'm talking about, you know, if you leave a facility in some cases, you know, depending on whatever context it is, you're in cuffs, handcuffs. You know, so again, it would have you to raise questions. What kind of environment, you know, is at home where a child would rather stay in prison?
Wow.
You know, and so for many of these girls, when they get out, you know, unfortunately, there aren't alternative spaces, you know, to put them in. You know what I mean? And so, which is why amongst girls, there are high rates of runaways. You know, which unfortunately amongst girls, you know, many of them get caught up in the trafficking, even when they get out. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, this need to create safe spaces for our girls. You know, and I just want to highlight one state, for example, you know, for survivors of sex trafficking is the Ann's House, you know, through the Salvation Army Promise Program in Illinois. You know, and they actually house girls who are survivors of sex trafficking. You know, and I mentioned Ann's House because what they do is literally they design a program specifically for survivors of sex trafficking. So that means it accounts for their, you know, victimization, their exploitation, their trauma, and it's girl-focused. So they're just not put in any, like, group home, for example. They are put in a space that specifically, uniquely that addresses their unique needs as
mm-hmm.
survivors. We need more of those spaces. We need rehabilitative, holistic, trauma-informed, gender-informed healing spaces for our girls. And currently, not enough of those spaces exist.
Not enough of those spaces exist, and not enough people even are calling for them. People don't even understand the urgency for them, right? They don't exist, but even if the conversation can be started in the policy rooms that call for it. And that's why, again, I'm so appreciative of your voice and the work that you're doing to even – people need to be woke. And too many people are people. I won't even just put this on, you know. I know white supremacy seeps into every facet, every culture, everybody, you know, nobody escapes it. And patriarchy also. But I think our people, too, need to understand, you know, our schools, our educators, our parents, you know, those people who are working in law enforcement, those people who are supposed to be advocates on behalf of girls, they all need to come to the understanding that rehabilitation is the foremost thing, right? That is your job. That is the outcome that we're searching for. The outcome is not to keep someone in prison for their entire lives or to set them on a cycle of imprisonment for the rest of their lives. It is to find redemption for them to be rehabilitated. So absolutely.
Yeah, and thank you for pointing out, you know, the need for us to take responsibility. You know, Sherita Morrison, the founder of Demoiselle de Femme, a renowned organization, you know, in Chicago that's been serving girls for over 20 years on the south side of Chicago. She, you know, and I thought this statement that she said was critical, you know, and powerful. She said, girls are the birth canals of our communities.
Absolutely.
you know? And so, you know, what happens, you know, when girls are no longer in our community, you know? And so when I think of the unique girls' role, the unique roles that girls play in family, you know, in the family context, in the community context, I mean, we cannot afford to lose them, you know? Unfortunately, you know, we have just far too long, and we can look at it from a micro and macro level, that we have always sacrificed our girls.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Especially in we sacrificed them in the expense of boys, you know, for the protection, yep, or whatever, of boys and men, right?
Yep.
I've seen it in my family, and now we see it in a structural and systemic context. I mean, we've always had, right? And so even now in the juvenile justice system, we see it here too. You know, but yes, it is our responsibility, you know, to take care of our children, you know, and take care of our girls, especially, you know. And then I want to, you know, narrow it down to, you know, the Black community too. You know what I mean? And looking at our responsibilities, you know. So when I think of folks who hold Black wealth, the philanthropists, all of that stuff, you know, I am clear. You know, it's not going to change unless we change it. You know, it's not going to be addressed unless we, you know, address it. You know, and so I'm saying that we really need to pull our resources together in a serious way, you know, to create these safe havens, you know, for our children. I mean, it is imperative, because if we don't, our future is at stake, literally. Literally.
And nobody's coming to save us. Nobody else is coming to save our
kids. Not one. Yes.
Not. You know, and so since we're talking about that, we're talking. You led into the next question. You introduced the word resources. Tell me exactly what you need for the work that you're doing with She Dreams of Freedom, specifically, but in any other capacity. What is it that you need to help forward, you know, what your objectives?
Yeah, so, I mean, look, I need money, you know, it's funny you say that. I'm actually about to go on an aggressive fundraising campaign, you know, to raise money for She Dreams of Freedom. I work closely with videographers. They're a core component of my work, you know, but we know that they're not free, you know what I mean? And I have some incredible videographers who are also co-content creators, you know, but, yeah, I need money to build content. And so that looks like, doing more videos, public service announcements. That looks like, I need funding, you know, to support girls. You know, I have found that, you know, empowerment is an incredible intervention strategy when working with vulnerable and at-risk girls. You know, and so what I've done, you know, while doing this work, I've started, you know, an empowerment portion of my project called Girl Magic, Igniting the Power Within. You know, and so I've been going to girls, literally, who, you know, in New York, it's a program called Close to Home, and it's for girls who committed nonviolent offenses, which are majority of them. Instead of, you know, them serving in detention, they actually serve it in, like, community-based residential settings. So I've gone there, you know, and invited some girl advocates, you know, who have definitely committed to the development of girls. And what we go is we really talk to them about what we have identified as tools of power. And so those tools are self-definition, self-love, self-care, and sisterhood. And so we literally engage them in a dialogue around these issues. Around these tools of power, you know, and one of the requirements, you know, for the women, the expectation is to be just incredibly vulnerable and transparent, you know, and we have seen, like, the most response from girls, you know, in these spaces where we come to them and engage them in these conversations around those four tools of power. You know, I mean, it's incredible, you know, and just the feedback, you know, and I've come to learn that these children are resilient, and regardless, they have an indomitable will to live, you know, and they just, you know, want love and support, you know, and so I want to continue to do that work with Girl Magic. So far, we have put on a Girls Empowerment Summit in New York. You know, we've been getting requests to do more Girl Empowerment Summits, you know, but one of the major barriers is funding. you know, and support for much of this work, we don't necessarily charge, you know. I mean, and if we do charge, I mean, the fees are, like, minimal. Like, we don't necessarily make money off of this stuff. So, yes, I need... You said what?
I said, can you repeat that? We do not make money off of this.
No, we do not make money off of this. This is our contribution to save our girls. You know, yeah, this is a contribution to save our girls. You know, because when I think, you know, of my own adolescence, when I was in a really tumultuous, horrific space, one of the things that kept my spirit alive was reading women's memoirs, you know, and just really immersing myself in, you know, empowerment and motivation. You know, and I'm telling you, when I meet Iyanla Lanzon, and I've met her before, but when I meet her now, you know, as a woman, you know, I'm going to say thank you. I'm going to thank her for her stories, because this Destiny sister, many of her books, you know, kind of got me through. You know, hers and others, you know, Cupcake Brown, you know, others, you know. So, yeah. And so we find the same response when we go to these girls who have these risk factors. You know, we've also been to girls who have parents who are incarcerated, you know, and we know that there's a link, you know, for children whose parents are incarcerated, they are higher risk of themselves being incarcerated, you know. So we do this work, you know, our intention to do this work is really to empower them and to hopefully, you know, if we can just reach one, you know, to interrupt this pipeline. So we need funding to continue to do the empowerment work, to create content, and, of course, to develop programming, more programs to support this population. So everybody's doing work now with girls. Sis, you've done it for years, right? And so, you know, my contribution is working on this specific population. You know, I found that girls who are incarcerated have most likely gone through every system. Like, the incarceration is almost the last stop.
Yeah.
You know, and my biggest fear is for these girls, you know, like my brother, to then, you know, end up in adult prison, you know. And, I've actually served a part of an assessment team where I did go and to women's prisons, you know, and many of the women had juvenile justice histories, you know, and it's just like, you know, I'm looking at them and I'm hearing them and I'm like, you know, damn, we failed you. You know what I mean? We failed you. Because if we could have got them at the you know, when they were girls, you know, this could have stopped. This could have stopped. And so I'm talking about women who serve, you know, some life sentences, some, you know, 20, 30 year sentences, you know, where most of their lives are in this system.
And oh my God, this is another soul crushing part of it is that, as you talked about before, it's so many layers, it's so many intersecting fights and fronts that we need to pull together. Like you said, it's the race justice, it's the education, it's reform, juvenile justice reform, but it is also, you know, things that we have endured for generations. You know, epigenetics, the research that's going on with that can tell us that some of this stuff is informed by generations of trauma, generations of mental illness. You know, this is so very deep, sis, that it's going to take all hands on deck. That's why I love that you lifted up Sherita Morrison, who is, as you said, the founder and the CEO of the executive director of Demoiselle the Film. Demoiselle the Film is also the convener of Southside Coalition on Urban Girls, which my organization, Girls Like Me, is a part of, because the work that we all bring to the table is necessary because our girls are hurting in so many different areas, and all of those areas are gateways to the prison industrial complex.
Yes. Yes. Sis, you said it. Yes.
So if we're talking about sex, you know, if we're talking about drug use, alcoholism, if we're talking about sexual exploitation, we're talking about school retention and dropout rates, if we're talking about incest, if we're talking about poverty, all of these things are gateways to prison. And
yes.
If you don't understand the cycle, you know, that's been going on for years, generations, if we don't take a look at that, that we're going to be in the same space we're in another 100 years from now. So, again, I thank you for your work that you're doing. I lift you up. I hope people were listening and heard that need, that cry for what's needed. And it is resources. It is the space. It is the expertise. It is the money, the money, the money, the money, the money.
Yeah.
Nothing can happen.
Yeah.
Our passion does not fund work.
Right. You know, and in addition to the money, which is critical, I would also say, you know, just utilization of platforms, like what you've done to me since you've extended your platform, you know, to invite me on, and, you know, and likewise, you know, I write, you know, so I would like to extend my platform to you. You know what I mean? And that's what I mean, just the extending of platforms so we can get this message out to as many outlets as possible, you know, because, I mean, people don't know what they don't know. You know, and you know, and spreading awareness again, you know, through various means, is a part of the work, you know. So that too, you know, invite us out, invite us to speak, invite us, you know, to be a part of the table, you know, to be a part of the conversation, give us a seat at the table, you know what I mean? Like all of that, we need that for the work and for the sustainability of our organization.
Absolutely, and I also want to just lift you up again to say how appreciative I am of you, but not just appreciative, but also that I just honor you for the woman you are and the approach that you have for this work. Collaboration is not just a word, you know, it's a verb.
Yes.
It's a demonstration, you know, you have to be, it's a demonstrative word. And I love the way you demonstrate collaboration. You are so unselfish. You share opportunities. Whether people, if you think that it's a fit for somebody, you share it openly. And I think more of us need to do that because,
yeah.
Again, it's enough work, it's enough pain, it's enough trauma.
I'm telling you.
To put your hands on it and try to be a part of the healing. It's enough
right.
to go, it's enough for everybody's hands.
Right.
But if we understand that, then we won't have a problem with opening up our platforms. We'll understand that it discords. It makes our load a little bit lighter.
Yeah, you know, and you know, thank you for that. And to that point, I got clear. You know, I got clear that this work is not about me. I mean, it affects me, you know, and when I say that it affects me, I think it's directly contributed to my own healing work. But at the end of the day, you know, I've committed my life and my professional career and all that, you know, to these girls, you know, and I'm clear about that, you know. And then I'm also clear, too, that this is my purpose work, you know, work that I feel that the Creator has called me to do, you know. And so, and since I came to that understanding, I can't afford to be selfish. You know what
right.
I mean? Any opportunity, anything, like, you know, anything that comes, like you said, you know, I'm open, I share it, you know, because, again, if our girls are to be saved, you know, just to reiterate what you said, it's going to take all of us to be, you know, all hands on deck, all hands to the plow.
And it is healing. I had, and it's a shame that I can't, my very first podcast episode, Butterfly Project, and that work, healing work, and it was about how do you transform the lives of girls before you get your own spirit intact, right, before it comes to who you are and why you're approaching this work, and to know, first of all, that we all need healing, right? And if we come to it in that light, like you just said, if we come to it knowing that this is healing work for our souls as well as girls' souls, then we better serve. And that's when we open ourselves up to hear from the people we're trying to help, whether you work with girls who are faced, you know, girls, whether you're working with homeless population, whether you're working with drug recovery, whatever it is, to know that your own healing is a part of the process. So, sis, I thank you again. I'm in awe of you, and I love how God is working for you. I love how you are opening yourself up to do more work, as painful as the journey can be, because I'm just a very transparent person. And I know for sure firsthand experience how painful this work can be. When you mm-hmm. when you love anything, it is sometimes a labor of love. And I know that the road can be full of disappointments and joy. It can be full of the unrequited love. But I also know, just like when we have our own children, that the greatest joy is in freeing someone, is in seeing freedom light up in a little girl's eyes, and seeing a young woman understand her power. And there's nothing more that is more rewarding than that. So I thank you for fighting the fight and staying in the trenches. I thank you for taking your voice and this work around the country, and I dare say around the world, because I know that this work will extend, and the work you're doing will extend global boundaries. And so I'm speaking that now, and I'm saying that whatever I can do myself as a sister, as the producer of this podcast, as the executive director of Girls Like Me, whatever I can do, wherever I stand, I will also make a space for you and this work that you're doing, because I believe in it, I believe in your commitment to it, and I believe in your spirit of love for our people. So, sis, go ahead and tell everybody where they can stay connected to you, how they can get in touch with you, how they can stay connected, and how they can find out more about She Dreams Freedom.
Thank you so much, sis. And I want to say, likewise, as you know, you're a sister who I have profound respect for, whose work I admire, so thank you, and thank you for your labor and contribution in this work. You know what I mean? And I stand on your shoulders, and I'm telling you, as I work side by side with you. So thank you. As far as She Dreams of Freedom, you can find us literally at shedreamsoffreedom.com. And on the website, you'll see my first public service announcement. And then you'll also see information about how to donate, where to donate. And also on the website, I have a services part where, I just really describe some of the type of services that we do, which includes a professional development, tech co-training assistance. We do workshops on understanding this issue. We break it down, understanding trauma, all that stuff. Check us out. I also have a portion on there in the services tab where, I have support for girls. So it looks like hosting the Girl Magic Summit. It looks like inviting us, to facilitate a panel with your girls. And it also looks like motivational speaking, empowerment speaking, as I would like to call it. And also some group work. I was trained in Girls Moving On. It's a 6-week curriculum-based trauma-informed, gender-informed program, where we sit with girls and we just go through, all this stuff. And it's tailored, it was created and tailored specifically for girls who are justice involved. So there are so many things that She Dreams of Freedom offers, and that we want to just extend to the general public. Use us, that's my ask. And then, like I said, you'll find some information on how to donate. Like us on Facebook at She Dreams of Freedom. Follow us on Twitter, She Dreams of Freedom. And continue to tell everybody that you know. Just spread our information. We want this stuff to hit like wildfire. And if you have any questions, you want to get in contact with me, shedreamsoffreedom@gmail.com. And you can, add me on Facebook, Liz S. Alexander.
Liz S. Alexander.
Liz S. Alexander.
There's some other Alexanders out there, but this is the one and only Liz S. Alexander. So make sure that you are looking for that, sis. I so appreciate you. I want to also share, I remember this book that I read in high school. You were sharing the memoirs of Cupcake Brown and Iyanla Vanzant, and we can go on and on. Maya Angelou's book saved my life. But Patrice.
Which one says?
Oh, especially Singing and Swinging and Getting Married Like Christmas. Yes. When she went deep into the things that she faced in terms of being a 16-year-old runaway, pregnant, single mother, process everything. That to me showed nobody is perfect. Even our giants are not perfect. And that their walk is all of our testimony. But also, there was a book by Patrice Gaines. It was called Laughing in the Dark. That book, when you want to talk about the prisoner pipeline and you want to talk about sexual exploitation and how we wind up coming from good homes and still, you know, because that's a misconception, is that all of the girls who are just as involved come from, you know, broken families and despair and poverty. And there's
right.
a lot of girls who are also living in suburbia who also find themselves in the same space.
Yep.
So I wanted to say to check that book out, Patrice Gaines, Laughing in the Dark. And then there's a movie, there's a documentary on Netflix. It's called Girlhood.
Yes, saw that. It was incredible. I highly recommend everybody to see it.
Incredible. And not so much, I won't give it away, but I just think that it didn't show what you're talking about. It just showed why there is a need for it. And so if people watch this, they will see what happens if you don't do the things that Liz mentioned to us, the spaces, the safe spaces and the rehabilitative spaces, if those are not in place, if the holistic freedom of girls is not in place, we'll be in trouble, and girls themselves will be in trouble. So those are the things I want to leave with people. Follow Liz. Go check out the website, SheDreamsOfFreedom.com. Like them on Facebook, SheDreamsOfFreedom.com. Write the check to SheDreamsOfFreedom.com.
Amen. Amen.
Let's do this work. Sis, I appreciate you. Love you so much. Thank you so much for joining Voices of Advocacy Radio today.
Thank you so much, sis, and take care. I love you, too.